But the relationships with the Department of Education are really critical. Because as I go back to the federal discussion, you know, as state agencies have said, from a consensus standpoint, we think that alignment with the U.S. Department of Labor would be the direction we want to go in if the U.S. Department of Education goes away. That's only if. And it creates a challenge for blind agencies, for example, because U.S. Department of Labor is not providing blind babies programs. They're not doing programs for those younger populations, and they're not doing those programs that we do in terms of independent living or older blind. And so there is not a direct alignment, especially for blind agencies, if we were to move to the U.S. Department of Labor on the national side. And so again, that's why education is so important for us. We do have some new leadership at RSA. Christopher Pope is the acting commissioner of RSA. Longstanding leadership there. Carol Doback, who's been bureaucrat in the position for a long time. It almost sounds like a four-letter word, even though it's like an eight-letter word or more. Who's been in a position for a long time as retired. And so when we think about Chris Pope, again, we've got relationships with Christopher Pope. We've had our opportunities to spar about some things over time and discuss different things, but he's been a great friend. He's been a great collaborative partner. He's got a relationship, good relationships with Senior Chancellor Ritchie as well. So you think about those connections and how all of those things work together going around. Some of the challenges that and opportunities that are before us, right? So the administration has been talking about deregulation. And a lot of times we think about deregulation, we say, uh-oh, deregulation is a problem because they're going to eliminate regulations that protect people. I think for our programs, deregulation is not necessarily a bad thing because there is a lot of, exactly, exactly. So there are a lot of regulations or number of regulations. So a regulation is this. So they pass a law, and then after they pass a law, the department writes a rule or regulation to implement the law. Sometimes the departments take liberty in implementing the law. They put more there than what needs to happen. And in the case of RSA, again, where we get those dollars from, they take, and most of their regs might mostly align to the law, but not completely. And in some of those interpretations in terms of implementation, they create more challenges and more barriers for us to implement the programs. And that's the truth. But then they take it even further than that when they give what's called sub-regulatory guidance. So then they give you a policy, or they give you a technical assistance guideline document, or they give you some dear colleague letter or something that they write that says, this is how we're interpreting the regulation that was interpreting the law. And there's a lot of challenges in those sub-regulatory guidelines. There's a lot of challenges even where they monitor the state agencies that create a whole lot of other challenges in terms of how we implement. When you talk about counselors trying to do counseling and the reason why they got to do so many data endpoints and things in the system, that takes away the face-to-face interaction and face-to-face time. A lot of that happens because of the regulations and the sub-regulatory guidance. And I think from my perspective, as I talk to our colleagues around the nation, this is our chance. If we have an administration that wants to eliminate regulations, well, here's a few for you that can be eliminated. Here's some sub-regulatory guidelines that we believe can help us to do more in terms of direct service. And so now, just this week, May 12th, the administration through the Office of Management and Budget on the federal side, they asked for public comment about regulations that were unnecessary, unlawful, unduly burdensome, unsound, inconsistent with the statutory text or the Constitution, or that exceeded the cost-benefit analyses. And I had some conversations with folks on the federal side about some thoughts around some of those things, and they put together some guidelines or some comments. I know also that the state of Florida also looked at some of those things, as well as they looked at DOGIE, looking at government efficiencies and those kind of things, to provide some ideas about regulations that can go away that hopefully will allow us to spend more time directly serving clients as opposed to doing a lot of what I've described with RSA regulatory minutiae. So those are some of the things that have been happening on the federal side. Of course, there's been a lot of discussions about executive orders. And one of the things that I shared with our rehab counselor earlier, I think it was last week when we were there, is that, you know, we know that there's been a lot of efforts about dealing with things relating to DEI. We'll just put that out there directly, right? Diversity, equity, inclusion, and funds being spent around DEI. I want folks to understand that the administration's interpretations of DEI does not include people with disabilities in the aspect of saying that, you know, this is a DEI thing that we need to cut funds away from. We've seen as they passed the budgets this year, for this year, we actually received our federal funds for our Voc Rehab program. And not only did we get our federal VR funds, we actually got a double cost of living increase nationally to serve individuals with disabilities. Now, that's the good news and it's bad news, right? So the good news is that we were not expecting it. We were surprised. As you talk about dodging and efficiency and cutting back, and we know looking for ways to save, that the administration actually gave us a cost of living increase that had been withheld when the last continuing resolution, where they gave money to the states, they gave us that money, and then they gave us catch-up money as well, which is really good. And again, that's been distributed to the state agency. It's a double-edged sword, though, because if the states aren't able to spend the dollars, and by the way, Florida is in a position where we're not currently able to spend the dollars. If we're not able to spend the dollars, then it becomes a place where cuts can happen in the future. And so we've talked about before that some of our challenges in the state of Florida is our constitution and our laws in Florida require that before we can receive the federal dollars, the legislature has to give us permission to accept them. Now, we get federal dollars every year, and we've had a budget, so to speak, of how much we can receive, but the amount federally has continued to go up because of cost of living adjustments, like the double we just got. And so we have not been able to receive all of the federal dollars. And so last year we went to the legislature, the governor put in his budget, the legislature put in their budgets, but when it came to the last day of the session, when the bill got printed, they did not give us the dollars or the authority to receive the funds that we needed. We weren't able to get it. We had to send $6 million back to the feds last year. Now, two parts of that. On one hand, we sent $6 million back. On the other hand, it does not mean we spent less in vocational rehabilitation funds. It means we were not able to receive that full $6 million. That doesn't mean we spent less in the state of Florida. But at the same time, we like to receive those funds. This year, the governor has it in his budget. The House and Senate also have it in their budgets as well to give us those dollars that we requested. Now, the dollars that we requested were based on not having the cost of living adjustments. And so even if it passes through the legislature, we still won't be able to receive all the dollars that are available through the cost of living adjustments. And so we'll have to go back again and ask for those dollars next year. But the other challenge we're dealing with this year, as some of you all may be aware, is that the legislature was not able to finish its session on May 2nd and close out with a budget. The one thing that they're required or, you know, brought together is to pass a budget every year. Of course, you've got a lot of bills and other things that get passed along the way. Well, they were not able to successfully pass a budget this year. And the reason why they were not able to successfully pass a budget is because there have been some major differences in the approach of budgeting from what the governor has in his budget. And by the way, we work for the governor. We support the governor's recommended budget. his budget included about $3 billion in cuts from last year's budget, but he included everything that we asked for blind services and what VR asked for as well. And so very, very well supporting the programs and services that we have as an organization. But he had in his budget to give us what we need for budget authority, as well as give us some additional dollars for general revenue dollars as well. He had in his budget. Again, I said the House and Senate also had in their budget, but the governor had an approach to tax cuts. The Senate also had their approach and the House had their approach. And again, I don't want to take too much time talking about this because there may be other questions and things. The bottom line is that the House has a very different approach to dealing with budgets and tax cuts this year. The House wants to cut an additional, I believe it was another $4 billion from what the governor was doing. And there is a gap between what the House wants to do and what the Senate wants to do. The House wants to fund the House tax cut proposal, which would reduce sales taxes from 6% to 5.25%. They want to fund that in a variety of ways, but one of the ways the House wants to fund that is by cutting positions at DBS. And not just DBS, VR and other places. What the House has proposed in their budget and passing their budget is to cut 52.75 DBS positions. That would lead to some waiting lists. That could lead to, I hate to say an order for selection. Yeah.
I'm off mute. So that would present an interesting challenge because as long as I've been around, you know, we're proud to say that Florida has not gone on order of selection, and that normally, you correct me if I'm wrong, we'll have a little dialogue here because I think it's more fun for the people, right, to see a spar up here. Most times states and agencies go on order of selection because of the lack of funds. Mm-hmm. This would be forcing us into jacking up our perfect record of not being on order of selection, because even the general agency, for the record, it has not been on order of selection for quite a while. Not because they are unable to allocate or source the funds to serve these individuals, but because they don't have the manpower. I'm gonna go down this rabbit hole, and Director Doyle will jump in if I'm over speaking, but look how slippery this slope is. If they're not able to serve because of a shortage of manpower, those dollars don't get spent, and it puts us back in jeopardy of losing some of those dollars and having to give back some of those dollars. I mean, folks, it is a vicious circle. It is a vicious circle. Did I, Mikey Wiseman, that enough for you?
You did. You did. And just to emphasize and punctuate the point to that, during our spring conference, RSA said that they've just had to go and approve amendments for 10 states to create order of selection.
Folks, we do not want that. This was one of the things that I specifically spoke to everybody about when I put out a call to arms with the bill, with APD. They live. They don't know what not being on order of selection is. And order of selection goes by categories of most significantly needy or impaired. And I'm going to shoot from the cuff here, even though I might be using some of the wrong legal terminology. But the majority of us come to the agencies because we can't see. We don't want to be pinned up against an individual who is more significantly challenged with multiple disabilities or something like that. But this is not even that type of order of selection. I mean, I wouldn't even know if I was on the rehab council and I was having to advise the agency how they would filter that out. Like Director Doyle is putting up a little bit of a red flag, and I see it, and we will watch this. But so stay tuned. It sounds like there might be another call to arms. So.
Absolutely. So
what I wanted to hear today, sir.
Yeah, I'm sorry. because that's the challenge. That's the challenge. So the legislature, as I mentioned, was to end on May 2nd. They are still very far apart in terms of where they want to go budget wise. The House wants to do permanent tax cuts with sales taxes. That will be partially funded by cutting positions at DBS. And basically what they looked at is positions that were vacant for more than 90 days across different state agencies. And we've, you know, it's sometimes it can take 180 days just to fill a position. And I can't tell you how many situations that we've had where we have, you know, had somebody. We've got, you know, it's taken us 120 days to get them in the pipeline, to get them approved. And then at the end, it says, oh, give me another month and I'll start because I got to give my job notice. And then they go back and negotiate with their job. And then they say, I changed my mind. I'm not going to come. And that happens. It has happened more often than I like. Even with the raises that we were able to give in the last couple of years, we're still finding that people are using those wage increases to leverage more money in other positions in other places. And so it continues to be a challenge for us in terms of that. And so when the legislature comes back, I think, again, it's important for our consumer groups and others to say, hey, we support the governor's recommended budget because that governor's recommended budget funds the programs and services that we requested and that we need for DBS without any cuts to staff. Now, fortunately, the Senate's budget that they passed, again, they got to come together and agree on which version or compromise. The Senate's version did not cut any DBS positions and also included funds for the programs and things that we need. And so what our hope is that as they negotiate, that we don't lose some of that in the process. And so, again, I think that continued education is important. And so they're saying that they're not expecting to come back before Memorial Day. They're not expecting to come back in session, which now puts us at the, you know, at June, really. We've got budgets that typically would kick in on July 1. And I mean, there is optimism that the legislature will pass a budget. I know the governor has threatened veto if things are not where they need to be. There is a possibility, I'm not saying a probability, you know, because there's difference between what's possible and probable, but there is a possibility, maybe a small probability, that if things don't work out, that we could end up without a budget in time. And if we end up without a budget in time, well, two things, it's setting us behind the timeline in terms of July 1 contracts and contracts of services. So that creates a challenge for us in terms of implementation, could delay some services on one end. But if you have a situation where the budget does not get passed or does not get passed in time, you could have a shutdown of non-essential services until a budget gets passed. And so, again, I certainly don't want to give gloom and doom because I think there's enough folks out there doing fear mongering about gloom and doom and, you know, they're telling you this is going to happen and that's going to happen. And, you know, I had somebody tell the administrators, don't say you, they wanted us to fight for the U.S. Department of Education. And it's like, well, we can't fight for the U.S. Department of Education. We need to fight for VR. We need to fight for the programs. We're not going to fight for the U.S. Department of Education. But, you know, it's like, you know, they say, well, if you say labor, they're coming after labor next, you know, and it really just trying to create fear. We certainly don't want to do that, but we do want folks to be aware of what the realities are relating to that. I've seen some positiveness. I've seen that the Speaker of the House, who's been the providing the most resistance and the most challenges in this legislative session relating to coming to a compromise in terms of disagreement with the governor, has created, I think, a task force to look at one of those budget areas that the governor has asked about relating to tax cuts for property taxes. And so I've seen a task force created recently, which shows some movement there. But overall, there's been a lot of heel digging taking place. Let me give you a couple other quick updates, and I want to have some time for questions. And again, not just given all this government stuff. We've strengthened our contracts for independent living, older blind babies and children, and pre-employment transition services. We've in these contracts that will be coming out July 1, pending, you know, budgets and all of those things, we've put more language in there around protecting the health and safety of our clients. We put language in there requiring certain reporting, incident reporting, making sure that the providers have policies and procedures and protocols in place to protect our consumers. That was a main focus of these contracts. Other things that we've done within those contracts is we've changed them into 3-year contracts so that we're not spending every year updating the contracts and updating language so that we can get some continuance of service moving forward. And so those are some of the things we've done. Also, we talked about the Senior Equipment and Training Program. And again, I want to say again, your very own Paul Edwards, who is the chair of our Blind Services Foundation, just through a number of years have been working with the division, and they've been given dollars. And now the division is also matching those dollars so that we can purchase equipment for seniors that we have not historically had funds for from the division. You know that the Florida Council of the Blind is the one that came to the division a few years ago and says, we think you need to put a $500,000 request in the budget for older blind services. You suggested it. We asked for it. They funded it. And so we've been getting that the last year as well. And the Senior Equipment and Training Program this year, I think we've done at least $130,000 on equipment that individual that we typically have not had the resources as an agency to fund in the past. And so there's a committee of DBS staff working along with Mr. Edwards and the committee, and they've been reviewing requests for equipment. that seniors may need access to. And we know there's an intent to fund that again next year. We know we have an intent to also match those funds again next year as well. And so if you don't know about it, tap into it. All right. The other thing that the Blind Services Foundation, as well as our Rehab Council for the Blind, has been working on is innovative projects. We put out a request to entities, not-for-profit entities, to say, hey, come up with an innovative idea that fits certain criteria that we can fund through the division, through dollars that have been donated. And so we had seven proposals that came through. We are recommending funding, I believe, three of those proposals. And so for you all to just be aware of, down in the Miami area, we're recommending funding a proposal there that through the Miami Lighthouse that will enhance employer awareness and engagement so that we're more jobs for our consumers. We've let Miami Lighthouse know that we're intending to fund that, but we've asked them to give us some new innovation, add some new innovative thoughts to their approach to engaging those employers. And so they said they were going to work on it. They're going to get something back to us I gave them to the 31st of May. Also, the Conklin Davis Center had a proposal where they wanted to create some digital content, create a digital content creation center and classes where they're teaching students how to do, how to monetize digital content, digital creation, communication. And so initially that was not recommended for funding by the committee. I actually saw innovation in the process and I really liked the idea, although there's some questions about making sure it's the right type of digital content and things like that. Right. So I had a conversation with Patrick Bat. Mike, you're all right. So we want to make sure we have the right type of content. So I spoke with them this week and I says, hey, we're willing to fund you partially. We're willing to fund the infrastructure, the equipment and things that they need. We're already funding the clients in terms of that. But give us a proposal that's going to make sure that we have the right type of digital content and that aligns with the infrastructure that we'll fund. Get that to us by the 31st, and then we'll look at potentially funding that. So we're looking at funding that to the tune of $32,000, about $800, about $30,000 from the Miami Lighthouse. And then the last one that we're looking to fund is a program through the Lighthouse The Lighthouse Vision Loss Education Center down in Manatee. they have a proposal about improving employability through basically creating credentialing for individuals, for clients in the technology area. You think about, you know, learning assistive technology, being able to learn the skills, gain the credentials to be able to serve and make money in those areas. And so they have a proposal of $50,000 that we are interested in funding there as well. And through that funding process, we have asked them for some additional innovation as well. And so in all, we're looking at funding about $113,000 for those programs or those proposals. Let me stop. I got a lot of other notes and things up here. But again, if I do a lot of talking and give you a lot of chance to ask a lot of questions, and time's almost over.
Folks, questions, comments?
So thanks for the presentation. I appreciate it. But I actually work for the federal government at the moment, and I'm kind of going back to what you said about what they're interpreting as DEI. They actually sent out emails to us with the executive order saying this will be the end of diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. That was actually in the email that was sent out to all of us saying that all of that will end. And if anyone is still continuing to provide those kind of services, that they need to be reported so that they can stop from doing that. Now, this is a federal government thing, not Florida government. But I'm just curious on your thoughts on that. I'm still waiting to see what exactly that's going to mean for those of us that are with reasonable accommodations working and such. But thought I would ask your thoughts on that.
Okay, so thank you for that question. So getting back to the DEI and the DEIA. So I'd be interested again in seeing that communication, because again, from what I've seen and heard and read, that I do know that when you first had, I remember, what was that, helicopter crash, and there was some conversation about how there were some folks who may have been unqualified, people with disabilities working in the FAA or working in the airport there. And I know there was been some backpedaling, I think, of some of that conversation. We have seen support for disabilities. We've seen support for our programs. We've seen support for those things. That, it doesn't mean that they don't come at some point where a challenge doesn't exist. That's why we continue to monitor and continue to advocate and educate along the way, not specifically relating to accessibility, but the DEI initiatives. And this is really primarily around gender, some folks use the term gender dysphoria, LGBTQ areas, where there has been an effort to roll back some of the aggressive ways that those things have been promoted or funded under the prior administration. And so those should not and do not directly impact us. And one of the areas I mentioned as well is that when the president's executive order around some of the DEIA, he actually specifically said that the Randolph Shepherd program, which is a business enterprise program, was not considered one of those programs that were targeted as a DEI type program. And so, again, I'd be interested in seeing that A on your end, but where they said accessibility or if they meant a different A relating to a DEI. I think from our perspective, and again, we've had this conversation on the national level as well, and I got to give short answers because I got two more hands, is that from the disability area, you know, we're trying to fight for the disability programs. We're trying to fight for the resources and funds on that side. And keep our main message the main message here. I think as others are advocating in their areas, they're advocating, communicating in those areas as well. But from the disability area, trying to make sure that we don't lose those dollars for people who are blind and have other disabilities.
As president of the Florida Council of the Blind, I want to reinforce that we acknowledge and understand that the swath of our membership is comprised of immense points of intersectionality. And there are times when, as an advocacy organization, we will stand at the forefront of what is a human right, an understood human right. And then there are times when we have to very much narrow our margins for dialogue to ensure that we're focusing on the B in Florida Council of the Blind, because opening that swath up may hinder our dialogue and our advocacy efforts. But it is a fine line to balance it. I can tell you from my own perspective as president of the Florida Council of the Blind, balancing out that intersectionality and being respectful and understanding of the organization and the members that I represent, it is at the forefront. But there are times when the conversation is intentionally narrowed to a legislative issue, to a delivery of service, to something contractual with the agency. But we do keep an eye on it. But thank you for raising that, and just know it is on our radar. It's just not always applicable to widen those margins.
Think about it from this perspective, and I do see the hand over there. You know, I'm celebrating 28 years of marriage, but I had to get her phone number before I could marry her. Right. So sometimes you got to get in the door first. And so you go in with your door opener and then you address those other issues when you're at the table. Mr. Edwards.
I actually, you'll be happy to know, don't have a question. I usually do. But I want to make a comment because I want to, it sort of fits in here. One of the things that happened at the Rehabilitation Council in Florida is we actually sent a letter to the Secretary of Education that I think you guys need to know about. And what that letter essentially said to the Department of Education is, we understand that you're considering making moves with regard to the Department of Education, and you certainly have the right to do that. And we're not suggesting that you don't. But what we do want you to recognize is that vocational rehabilitation isn't the only thing that ought to be considered. And what we asked them to do was to recognize that separate agencies like the one that we have in Florida serve babies and children and adults who aren't going to work and older blind people. And whatever system gets developed needs to assure that appropriate ways are found to ensure that those services can be properly and appropriately and fairly administered wherever the program gets moved.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Doyle. I'm from Miami, from the Miami Lighthouse. I'm with the vocational rehabilitation. I'm in the MIDI program. I'm studying to be a recording engineer and a producer. I don't miss class. I go to class every time that the time is presented. I get 4 hours a week. It's kind of hard to squeeze into that little bit of time all the things that I need to be doing. I have to make myself available to do other projects so that I can be current in my profession once I can complete it. So I'm trying to figure out why my case is closed. When I'm going to class as often as I'm told, then I get a call from the counselor at the Division of Blind Services asking me, how long is it going to take? I should be asking the counselor how long it should take because the counselor is supposed to advise me as to be able to facilitate.
This is Mikey, and I'm going to go ahead and interrupt you. At the beginning of this, I said we weren't going to be discussing individual cases.
Oh,
okay. But I'm sure that there will, if there's going to be an opportunity for follow-up, we will make note of where you're at and your name. It's just not, we just can't do individual cases right now. So I appreciate you understanding that.
Okay. And if I could do this, if I can, thank you, because I heard this recently from someone else as well. I know that our team has been challenging, and I'd love to hear from you all on this. I'd love to hear from you all. This is balance of the challenge. You know, we've got so many resources. I've mentioned we're only supposed to give 10% to our older blind program, but we're really doing like 60% from state dollars. And so there has been an effort to help the CRPs, to help clients who are not reaching their goals. And I'm not saying this is the situation here, particularly in our adult programs or our older blind programs and in voc rehab as well. You've had a case open for 12 years or 10 years, older blind, for example, and the idea is you're going in and you're getting some targeted services. You receive those services, that training, and now you have some independence, and then we're opening the doors for new clients to come in. Well, I know there's been an effort to close some of those cases that have been open for a while. And again, I heard this when I was in, we were at a rehab council meeting last week as well. And so the question is, you know, what do we do? What is that approach? Do we say, okay, folks stay on the older blind program for, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and continue to get services, and maybe not open up new avenues for other clients? Is there a time limit, so to speak? Certainly people can always come back for services if they need to. Or do we say, okay, you know, there's not been progress, and this has really become a social group or social activity. I know, for example, the Miami Lighthouse is created, they get funds for a social group activity program. So for people who are not actually going towards those goals. And I don't know if my question is making sense, but I would really like to hear the feedback from the community. You know, do we close those cases after a period of time of note when they're not reaching the successful closures, particularly older blind, or do we keep them open and keep providing those services even though we're not reaching a specific goal? I can tell you that the federal funds, and again, should be 90%, but it's more like 40, they want us to reach, get to a level of achieving a goal, but we've got to find a balance. And I think Adrian, again, you might experience this as you're looking at caseloads as well, but any feedback on that would be wonderful.
I will respectfully push back a little bit and say, I don't know if if earmarking or making the objective, we would have to determine what a successful closure looks like, right? And then we would get into some murky waters, which I'm happy to swim in with you, for real. Like, you know, objectives, measurements, and stuff like that. But we're going to have a few other key players. But if you would like to utilize the Florida Council of the Blind as a resource as far as some data collection, I'm sure that many of our members would happily volunteer, and we could create some type of community call or focus group or data gathering session, or a listening session in order to empower you to look at the scope of that. But I would, as a person who is employed, right, I know what a 26 successful closure looks like in a VR, but I would be very hesitant to put a mold together, given the fact that there's an I in those plans for individual, right? So each individual's success at the end of a program should be geared to what they need. But I, you know, we can definitely frame that conversation. And folks, this is how it works, right? Like, it's not just a love fest. Sometimes we'll rein each other in and say, "Oh, you want to talk about this? Let's do it." But I'm happy to do that. If we want to follow up and put that together, members, by way of applause, would we be willing to help DBS out with this?
With the question that you just asked, Director Doyle. No, I actually woke up and got two cups of coffee today. So I'm good. I'm going to just piggyback on this gentleman over here. In some of the lighthouses, they do have people who come there specifically for something, right? But they can't leave their families because they have small children. And so if the person is coming there and they say, "I want to open my own business," but they're older, right? So they're not going to catch on like somebody who's 22, right? So, Mikey, when we do this, we also have to take that in mind, right? We have to take in mind that if in your contracts, right, you said you only give the lighthouses, what, 10% or 10 hours a week or whatever it is. So if you're only given 10 hours, I'm only coming to the lighthouse once a week, right? I'm not going to be able to finish like I would if I went to the rehab, the TCCC, right? So I'm not going to finish that. So when we look at this, you guys, and I can say that because I've been both places now. When you look at that, make sure you keep this in mind, whoever the task force is, that you're not going to get every day, all day, whatever it is, right? You're going to get, you come every Monday, you come every Wednesday, you come every Tuesday. I just want to make sure you understand that. So, Dr. Dore, when you guys do this, just keep that in mind. And I know there's only so much you can say because we need to keep you where you are.
Is that we want the providers to provide as many service hours of service as possible. We want the clients to be moving towards achieving their goals. And that's what the purpose of those dollars are for. The lighthouse can give as many hours as they can afford to get, but I guess that there's a budget there as well. I see a hand in the back.
Good afternoon. I am Harsha Trivedi from Daytona Beach, and thank you so much, Director Doyle. And my statement to that is, with our vision, it always changes. So if we're talking about school age transition to adulthood, sometimes there is that process of change. And I feel that we sometimes waste time and efforts with paperwork because something may not be feasible to a person, and frustration kind of ends up on both parties, the client side and perhaps the office side. But I would definitely agree in the aspects of, if we want to make sure a person is successful, we should have a driven plan. However, if we're talking about even adulthood, in a program like IL, IL may not provide the money or dollars to a senior, but they are probably willing to go work or willing to go do something better. But the whole caseload process and how that kind of goes in circles, I think that's money wasted or time wasted, perhaps. Maybe not money, but time wasted. And that just might make the process a little bit more streamlined for both clients and the office. So I would agree that if we kind of keep the caseload open or have some parameters within that, that, you know, if it's something small like needs that I might want, let's say JAWS or Fusion, I could quickly contact and make it more seamless where we are more solid as Florida. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much for that comment. I think that part of it ties into where I talked about some guidance or sub-regulatory guidance, and sometimes they create more rules and things that make it more difficult for us to do some of those direct services. And so if we can eliminate some of that, then there's less paperwork that has to be done. But I appreciate that feedback. And again, we want to have a goal, but we want folks to be able to know that this is not a, you know, one and done, that you can come back to the agency for services as you need them. And I think there was also a question of accountability as well, because there's some challenges in some areas of whether or not maybe some of the providers were keeping cases open too long. And then you've got services that are, you know, you're paying more and more, and then, you know, then you have folks who were either maybe not reaching their goal, or you got people who are saying, hey, I want services, but the Lighthouse doesn't have the capacity to do it because they've got people who've been carried over for so many years. So we're trying to find the right balance there. All right. I don't see any other hands yet.
Anybody on Zoom? Got you. So for my Daytona person that just spoke, I do want you to, it's very important to recognize that the agency does listen to us. And a few years ago, we did, in collaboration with advice and guidance from the Rehab Council for the Blind, there is some streamlined, quicker services for individuals who are currently employed. You know, sometimes the landscape of your employment changes. And I have been one of those cases where a system-wide change impacted me so significantly that I needed a full rehab engineer in my office to understand what I was going through. They do what they can within the laws and within, you know, the oversight that they do. And it nothing does ever happen overnight. It is the government in the end. But I'm looking forward to further communication and putting together a resource for this particular conversation. So stay tuned. We are running right on time. So I'm going to let Director Doyle wrap up and say his adieu and whatever else he wants to say.
Thank you again for an opportunity to be here. Thank you for always inviting us and being welcoming to myself, to the members of my team as well from DBS. And I'll stick around for a little bit, not too much longer though, but a little bit before I get home to my wife. So, but thank you so much again. Thank you, Mr. President and FCB.
Thank you.